Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
And I'm Bob.
Oh gosh, Bob's here. And
Bob's here.
in addition to Bob, we have joining us a very special guest who you almost certainly heard as Edward Elric from Full Metal Alchemist, and now you will very soon know him as James T. Kirk, Vic Mignogna.
Well, hello, guys, and Bob's here. This is amazing.
I know, right? I mean, Vic is cool and all, but Bob is back.
I know, Bob.
Whoa, 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 guys.
Well, while we've got you here, Bob, you want to tell us how this whole thing came to be?
Yeah.
Sure. So over the March 30th weekend, which happened to be my birthday weekend, I was at SakuraCon with my fiance Megan, and we were just bebopping around and stuff, and I actually saw that there was a panel for something called Star Trek Continues. I'm like, hey, I'm a Star Trek fan. Let's go check this thing out. Yeah. Which I was actually SakuraCon kind of at my own behest, because I'm not really a huge like anime guy or anything like that. I'm not really into anime so much. Sorry, Vic.
Boo.
But I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so when I saw the Star Trek panel going on, I'm like, let's go do that. You know, this is my birthday weekend. I want to go do something I want to do. So she's like, okay. So we went in there and Vic talked a lot about Star Trek Continues and such, which I think is really cool. We're gonna get more into that here later on. And as you're finishing up your panel, Vic, that's when I got the bright idea of like, you know what, maybe I should go ahead and run down this celebrity and ask him to be on this podcast that he's never heard of on the internet.
Well, I'm very, very glad you did because any chance to talk about Trek and to talk about what the production that we're putting together here, I am honored to do so. So thank you for that, Bob.
Hey, you bet.
So on that note, I want to just get started with talking a little bit about Star Trek in general. So Vic, would you please enlighten us with descriptions of how you got into Star Trek in the first place?
Yes, tell us.
Well, when I was 9 or 10, 11 years old, I discovered reruns on my little 19-inch black and white television of this show called Star Trek, and I instantly fell in love with it, and it became an almost unnatural passion for me. I got my mom to teach me to make uniforms and to sew so I could make my own uniforms, and went to Star Trek conventions, and I put my cassette recorder in front of the television every day after school and recorded the episodes, and then I would put the cassette player under my pillow at night so I could listen to the episodes. And I'm not kidding you guys, I could quote entire shows verbatim. I ate, slept, and breathed Star Trek, the original series.
You have a
And
whole fanboy experience there, don't you?
oh my gosh, Grace, you have no idea.
That's
And
why we're asking, so.
so, you know, I've always had a childhood love of the original series. And you know, I must be honest and say that, you know, the subsequent series, the subsequent incarnations of Star Trek, I didn't quite find as endearing. I didn't they didn't quite grab me the way the original series did. And so I've always been a hardcore TOS fan.
Well,
And it started when I was very young.
what was it, do you think, about the original series that just that TOS had going on that, say, Next Generation or Deep Space Nine didn't?
Well, you know what? I was actually just talking to a friend of mine this afternoon who's actually going to be writing a script for our production, and we were talking about the fact that the original series had a kind of a an action gutsy attitude about it, and Next Generation kind of became more cerebral and in touch with your feelings and
Yeah, the
you
soap
know and
opera and space thing.
yeah, and you know what? You could kind of really it was really personified in the captains.
Yeah.
I mean, look at these two captains. Here's this, you know, strong, young, handsome, go get 'em, jump in where angels fear to tread, you know, Captain Kirk. And then here's this rather slight build, bald grandpa kind of diplomatic kind of a statesman in Jean-Luc Picard. A very different approach. And
I'm pretty sure you just called all the TNG fans out there. They like sissies better.
Can we start calling Captain Grandpa now?
No. But you know, let's just say Captain Kirk could beat the crap out of Captain Picard. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
But
although I'm not convinced that Captain Kirk could maintain his will to fight after listening to a Picard speech.
Well, that's true. That's true. But you know what? I wanted to like Next Gen, and I've actually become friends with a lot of the actors, and I liked a lot of the episodes. There were a lot of great Next Gen episodes. But I must say that TOS came into my life at a very, very interesting moment in my life as a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy.
So it's got a place in your heart.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't want to wax all psychological here, but my parents had just divorced, and I just latched on to this role model of Captain Kirk, and I loved the friendship and the camaraderie that they had between the characters and the cool phasers and communicators and things that they had. I would sit and build those things out of cardboard and wood and metal and paper all day long. And it captured my imagination. It kind of jump started my creativity. Mm-hmm. So whatever I went on to do after that, I kind of feel like Star Trek kind of jump started my creativity.
What about the animated series? Like, did you get to see that when it was airing?
You know what? I tried to watch it. I tried to like it.
That's probably the most common thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I wanted to like it, and I really liked that they had the original actors, but you know, the animation was so stale and kind of rough.
It's kind of got a face that only a mother could love. So.
Exactly. Thank you, Grace. Well put. Well put.
Well, Captain Kirk has about 3 facial expressions, you know.
I know, he's right? Able to make. And then they would just like make a pose and the camera would move toward the animation cell. They wouldn't really run. They would just zoom toward the animation cell.
Well, they would do like the Scooby-Doo thing where when they needed to have running, instead of actually animating the running, they would just show us some like silhouettes that were running. Those silhouettes could be anything, right? I mean, those are multi-purpose silhouettes you got right there.
Exactly.
Scooby-Doo run, not something you really want to think of when you think of Captain Kirk jumping into action.
There's this one episode where they have to send down like a team of all lady security officers. I forget why, but something has happened to all the male crew members. And they do like that thing where they cut away and show some silhouettes running. But the silhouettes are all clearly masculine. And I'm like, something has gone terribly wrong in this.
They got the guys to do the running for them.
You can't run
in a skirt like that.
Excuse me.
Please don't let us spend any more time on the animated series.
Well, back on the topic of ye olde original series, then, do you have a favorite episode?
Yes, I do.
What is it?
And you know what? It is off the beaten path.
It's not so the way to Eden, is it?
No, it's not. And it's not Spock's brain.
That's really.
You know what? It's one that just makes me cry every time I watch it. And, you know, most people like, you know, City on the Edge of Forever, Trouble with Tribbles, or, you know, a handful of those, Mirror, Mirror. My favorite episode was Requiem for Methuselah.
Ooh.
I absolutely loved that episode.
You can remind me what happens there.
Well, that's the one where the Enterprise crew was suffering from Regillian fever, and Dr. McCoy needed large amounts of Ritalin to make an antidote.
Not to be confused with Ritalin, right?
Exactly. This is long before Ritalin. But they go to this planet where there's supposed to be this mineral, and they meet this man who supposedly lives there by himself, and he takes them back to his home, where he pretends to help them get this mineral that they need, but then he introduces them to this girl who's the only other person living there, and she.
Oh, yeah. He's
and it turns out, and there are all of these amazing historical artifacts all around the house. There's like an original painting of by Da Vinci, and then there's this original handwritten manuscript of a Brahms composition, and there's a Gutenberg Bible, and there are all of these first edition things, and they've never been cataloged. And Spock's really fascinated by this. And meanwhile, Kirk's like falling in love with this girl. Meanwhile, Kirk's falling in love with this girl, and then what ends up happening is you find out that Mr. Flint, this old man, was actually all of these people throughout history. He was Brahms. He was Da Vinci. He was all these people, and he had created this woman. The woman turned out to be an android, and he had created her to be an immortal mate for him for all time, but she was emotionless. And he figured that if he exposed her to some humans and human emotion, that he could kind of bring her emotions to life. But the problem was that the emotions that he brought to life were falling in love with Kirk, and she didn't want to leave Kirk behind. She didn't want Kirk to go away.
I think that should be in like the owner's manual for if you're designing a love companion robot. Do not let it achieve sentience around Kirk.
Right. Don't let it hang out with Captain
Kirk. Rookie mistake right there.
But you know what? The thing that I love the most about this episode is something, you know, Kirk made out with a lot of chicks. We all know that, right?
That's given, yeah.
He made out with a lot of chicks. But you want to hear something interesting? A lot of people don't really think about this. There was only one – this episode, Requiem for Methuselah, was the only episode where Kirk asked the woman to come with him. Every other episode, Kirk was like, hey, you're cool and everything, but I got to go. I've got a ship. You got to stay here. I've got to continue on my mission. Sorry, I got to go. I can't take you with me. This episode was the only time where Kirk was so in love with the woman that he begged her to come with him. And the final scene where Kirk regrets his behavior and is so ashamed of the way he acted is one of the most powerful scenes in any episode for me. I love it. I love it, love it, love it.
When you see a cocky character like Kirk having to feel remorseful and to beg
exactly.
something.
Exactly. You know what?
Grace?
A cocky character like Kirk who's always so sure of himself, to see him in the last scene of Requiem for Methuselah sitting almost catatonic at his desk in his quarters, and he says to Kirk, he says to Spock, a very old and lonely man, and a young and only man, and lonely man, we put on a pretty poor show, didn't we? If only I could forget. And he lays his head on his desk, and you feel so much for how much he kind of put himself out there, and how ashamed he is of the way he acted. I loved it. So.
Well, you've
that's my favorite episode.
You've definitely made me think of that in a different context. I'm not used to really looking at Requiem for Methuselah as being a deep episode, and clearly I need to re-examine it.
Well, yeah, all those other chicks, he was like, I'm sorry, you can't come with me. And, you know? And he's like, you know,
it's
you've
all
got,
the,
you've
most
got
of his
to
relationships
stay behind.
Have ah, sorry, I'm interrupting you.
It's okay.
That's serious. Trivia question now that I can ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Was there a question?
No. That is a serious trivia question I can ask now. What happened at the end of
a statement, not a question. Okay.
Well, you know what you can say, Bob? You know what you can say? The trivia question can be, who is the only woman that Kirk asked to come with him?
Exactly.
Because everybody else, he's like, I'm sorry, I can't take you with me. You know, sorry.
I also think that this might represent a new chapter in Kirk-robot relations, because I don't think he tries to use word judo to destroy her at any point. It has been a while since I've seen that episode, so maybe I shouldn't be so certain about that.
I'm sorry, we have to stay on this for one more second, okay?
No, please.
That last scene, you guys, he lays his head on his... on his desk, on his hands, and he says, if only I could forget. He's so ashamed of the way things went down, and it's such a painful memory. And then McCoy walks in, and McCoy has one of the most wonderful monologues in the entire series. He looks at Spock and he says, "You know, Spock, I feel sorrier for you than I do for him, because you'll never know the things love can drive a man to. The glorious failures, the glorious victories, the desperate chances, this and that, all these things you'll never know simply because the word love isn't written into your book." And he starts
to leave. Man, you really do have this stuff memorized.
Yeah. And he starts to leave. He starts to leave the room and he turns around and looks at Kirk and he says, "I do wish he could forget her." And in the, one of the most beautiful moments, Spock walks over to Kirk and puts his hand on Kirk's forehead and says, "Forget."
Oh, what? Really? That's how the episode ends? Oh, gosh.
Yep. Yep.
So are we?
It's beautiful.
So Kirk doesn't remember any of that? Oh, boy.
Is that cool?
It's kind of the tragedy of it, isn't it? I mean,
there's a sequel in there.
Yeah, and such is his love, and such is his love for, such is Spock's love for Kirk, that he understands that this is such a painful memory for him, and he wants to help his friend. It's a beautiful moment on so many levels.
Yeah. Spock doesn't understand love, but at the same time, he doesn't want it to be the thing that's hurting Kirk like this.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Spock is the best bro.
Yeah, he's a great wingman.
You could say he's the best wingman in the galaxy. I mean, look at Kirk's record.
I feel like maybe I would abuse that power if I had a friend who could do that. Be like, "Hey, Spock, I had a terrible date. Can you come help me out with this?"
Yeah, right? He's like, I took my shot and I bombed miserably. Can you please wipe that out?
Just make sure I never remember doing that.
Oh, Spock, I finally watched the last season of Lost. I don't want to know how it ended. Get this out of my brain.
So now that you've told us...
Lieutenant Commander Brain Bleach Spock.
Now that you told us in beautiful detail about your favorite episode, do you have a least favorite episode?
You know what? I didn't really think that much of Mudd's Women.
You know, thank you. I'm glad someone else agrees with me.
And you know what? So many people like Harry Mudd. And I liked iMudd. I liked iMudd a lot. But the first Mudd's Women episode, I didn't think too much of that. That wasn't one of my favorites.
That's fair.
Well, I remember the first time I saw that episode, it was like, okay, I'm getting like a lot of different mixed messages out of this. Like, what is the audience supposed to be getting from this story? That it feels like there's an Aesop being wedged in there somehow, but it's just not quite coming through.
Yeah, I think they created this. I think they wanted to bring some humor to the show, so they created this Falstaff kind of a, you know, character in Harry Mudd. And of course, he really came into his own in iMudd. That was really a fun episode. But the first one, I don't know, not one of my favorites.
Hang on. I'm still thinking about the Requiem for Methuselah and the fact that I.
Dude, you need to end this interview and go watch that.
Let's go watch that again.
We can do it.
You know what else?
No, we have Netflix.
What was that?
And you know what else I love about that final scene of that episode? They used one of my favorite pieces of music from the series. Just beautiful.
Now, what did you think about the? Because there's a kind of a clear difference between seasons 1 and 2 and then season 3. So what did you think about season 3 of the original series?
I thought it had its moments. I liked it fine. Every time I hear people say that, I can think of a lot of really good season 3 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you're going to hit and miss with every TV show is going to have hit and miss episodes.
Right.
You know,
it's
so
inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't mind season 3 at all. Not at all, actually.
Okay.
Short answer, that's the truth.
No, that's fair enough. Just switching topics for a minute, you mentioned that you enjoyed the more action adventure type elements of the original series. Did you get far enough into Deep Space Nine to get into the Dominion War at all?
No.
Okay. Always with the Deep Space Nine, Warren. Well, he is always pushing the Deep Space Nine.
I like Deep Space Nine. I'm sorry. I wanted to know.
Well, that's fine. You know what, Warren? Let me answer that question by simply saying this. The original series of Star Trek got me at a very pivotal moment in my life as a boy. Mm-hmm. And the subsequent incarnations of Star Trek, in my mind, each one got further and further away from whatever it was about the original series that had such a lure for me. So I watched probably 60% of Next Gen, and I watched less of Deep Space Nine, and I don't even remember watching Voyager, maybe a handful of episodes, and I don't think I've ever seen Enterprise.
Yeah. Good boy.
So, you know, I mean, I may have just signed my own death warrant to a bunch of Star Trek fans out there that think that I can't possibly be a true Star Trek fan. But my childhood love affair was with the original series. Mm-hmm. And so,
That's fair.
Make no apology for it.
Yeah. The only reason I asked was just I thought that the Dominion War might be something you'd enjoy since it sounded like you liked the action-adventure quotient.
Probably so. You're probably right. And I've heard from a lot of people that there are some great episodes in the other series, and they actually sound quite intriguing. So now, as a grown man, I may go back and watch some of them.
Well, Netflix,
and would probably enjoy them.
Netflix is our friend in that regard.
Yes. Yes.
What about the movies?
Our best friend and worst enemy when it comes to procrastination.
Well, that's fair. But what about
personal?
What about the TOS movies, Vic?
Wrath of Khan. Period.
always going to be Wrath of Khan.
Wrath of Khan. Period. Wrath of Khan. Then Voyage Home, probably.
Space Whales.
And even though I didn't like that so much, I kind of liked elements of the movie. But again, nothing touches Wrath of Khan. Everything else is a distant second, third, fourth, fifth place.
How did you like the transition from like the TOS series Enterprise into the movie Enterprise?
I don't know. I have a very, very deep place in my heart for the original series Enterprise. Mm-hmm. I understand that they needed to upgrade it. I understand the strategy behind it. And it was a beautiful ship. I mean, they didn't change it enough. You know what I mean? They kept it close enough so that it still held that same kind of a place visually. But I'm rather indifferent to it. I like it fine, but I love the original series Enterprise.
How do you feel about Star Trek V?
Next question, please.
Eating the fifth for the fifth.
We have a lot. We have a lot of questions, and I don't want to spend time on that one.
That's fair. Do you have a favorite favorite antagonist alien race in Star Trek?
No.
No.
In fact, no. In fact, you know, no. I'm not real big on Klingons, Romulans thing kind of thing. I have no particular favorite.
Is that just because none of them really excite you a whole lot?
Yeah, I never found them terribly intriguing. I'm not to say that I don't like them. I just.
Right.
I don't. I mean, I never learned the Klingon Bible, and I never, mm-hmm. I never drank Romulan ale. I mean, I'm not that into the major antagonist species. But I mean, I like them. I like them for what they are, and that is a vehicle to tell a good story.
Right.
Well, that's even part of the goal that you guys have with Star Trek Continues. You know, I remember you were talking at the panel about it, about how a lot of other fan productions, you know, they are. You know, they have a lot of good CGI going on, but the actors aren't really acting so much because they're not actors.
Exactly.
But with Star Trek Continues, as you're explaining, and even with some of the vignettes that you guys got on the website right now, there's a lot of emphasis on the character drama. So I have the feeling that your interest lies not so much in a lot of the minutiae that is of Star Trek so much as it is seeing really great stories being told and these character dramas unfolding in front of you in Star Trek.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. You know what, you guys? Any television or movie has to come down to story. I mean, if you and I had a nickel for every time we went to see a movie that had amazing special effects and no story, or you know, huge production value, but the characters kind of left you flat, or they didn't develop a deep relationship, but what everybody remembers about Star Trek was not the amazing special effects because they weren't amazing. And it wasn't the sets or even the costumes, because there wasn't anything that blew your mind about those things. What people loved about Star Trek were the characters and the stories, the imagination, the imaginative stories they told. And you cared about the characters and their relationship with each other. And, you know, a lot of fan productions will create episodes that never really scratch below the surface, because that would require them to have actors that could go deeper, and most of them don't. I'm sorry, it's not personal. It's just an observation. Right. And so what I wanted from the very beginning was to cast people that weren't afraid to go deeper. That weren't afraid, like, you know what? I am looking
such a good job you did too.
Well, you know what? I appreciate that. And you know what, dude?
It must have taken some guts, man.
Wait till you see the first episode.
I can't wait.
Wait till you see the first episode, you guys. We have got some major drama going on with the actors and the story, and it's all about the story.
Can you drop
them? Sure, there are phasers, and sure, there are special effects and transporters, but they are completely secondary to the story and the characters.
Is that why you decided to do like a continuation of the original mission and not a new crew like they had going on Farragut?
Well, my love is for the original characters. And you know what? If you could go back in time and tell the 12-year-old or 13-year-old Vic that one day, as a grown-up, he would get to put on a uniform and walk onto the bridge of the Enterprise and play Captain Kirk, he would probably die at age 13 because he wouldn't be able to believe that that would ever be possible. So for me as a grown-up to be able to bring all of the things that I've learned over the years about production and acting and shooting and directing and editing and lighting and sound and all of it, everything that I've learned over the years, to be able to bring those things and merge them with my childhood passion is a dream and a privilege unlike anything I could have imagined.
I'm suddenly very jealous of your inner child right now.
I know, right?
Yeah. Look at the dream, man.
You know what, Grace? I look at pictures of me at 12 and 13 years old and home movies of me as a scrawny little 14-year-old kid dressed as Captain Kirk and trying to make these little home movies. And I think if I had no idea at the time that I would be able to partner together with other friends and rebuild the entire soundstage and bring people together and make start and continue to make Star Trek episodes. It's a gift. It's a gift unlike anything I could have dreamed of. And you know what? Let me say something. You mentioned Farragut.
Mm-hmm.
I have an enormous amount of love and respect and admiration for the Farragut guys, because I think it was a brilliant idea to take one of the other ships in the fleet and create a completely original crew and follow the adventures of that crew. I think it's a great idea. Mm. And I love these guys. We've partnered together and become close friends. I directed their last episode. I brought in my DP and my AD and a lot of my people into their last episode, and we made a really great episode for Starship Farragut. And that's how we came to know that we liked each other and loved all the same things, and we partnered together. And and I'm working with them on their subsequent episodes, and we've pooled our resources, so to speak, mm-hmm. and have created a really great partnership. I love those guys, and I have a great deal of respect and admiration for what they've done with Starship Variant.
Could you talk about the set a little bit?
Absolutely. Oh, God, don't get me started.
No, please. You'll never
I do want to get you started.
We're getting you started.
Okay, well, here it is. Here it is. We have acquired a 9,600-square-foot building outside of Jacksonville, Florida. And in that building, we have recreated the entire original soundstage. With the exception of the engineering section, we have rebuilt inch for inch to meticulous detail the original soundstage, the whole bending corridor with the transporter room branching off where it was, the sick bay where it was, the briefing room where it was, the captain's quarters where it was, even the Jeffries tube and the bridge set off in the corner just the way it was laid out in the original series. They're all interconnected, and it's the largest standing recreation of the sets on planet Earth. They have never existed like this since 1969 when they tore them down at Paramount Studios. And when you see the episode that we just shot, you'll see what I'm talking about.
I mean,
that is so insanely cool.
Oh my gosh, you guys, to walk through, to walk through the sets, you guys, to literally walk down the corridor.
Oh man.
And walk right into the briefing room. And then turn around and go back out into the corridor and walk down a little further into the transporter room. And then to come back out and walk across the hall into the sick bay. And then to turn around and go back down the corridor into the captain's quarters. It's crazy cool.
And crazy. Just for our listeners. Hang on a second, Grace. Just for our listeners, I want everyone to know that they actually don't have to wait entirely for the first episode to be done, because there are three really cool vignettes currently available on the Star Trek Continues website. Which
thank you, yeah. Thank you for mentioning that.
And we'll put the links to that once we post the episode. So
please do.
I recommend everyone take a look, because they kind of
The purpose of those vignettes were threefold. Number one, it was to pick right up where the original series left off. So for all of your listeners, what we did was we recreated the last 60 seconds of the last episode of Star Trek, Turnabout Intruder. And then where it ended, we immediately just continued seamlessly. The next vignette, again, to introduce and let the fans kind of become familiar with our actors in these roles and these characters. And then the third reason was the third vignette, the one called Happy Birthday Scotty, we wanted to introduce a new phaser. We wanted to use a new phaser in our series. Mm-hmm. It's a phaser that was designed by Scott Nakata, and at first glance, it looks just like the TOS phaser. But on closer inspection, it's got a lot of really cool new lines and designs and details. And we wanted to use it in our first episode, but we didn't want to have somebody pull it out in the middle of the episode and have it distract the viewer.
Yeah.
We didn't want them to go, oh my gosh, wait a minute, what is that? And have it take them out of the episode, take them out of the story, and have them, you know, wondering what's up with this new phaser. So what we did was we created our own little vignette where we actually showcase and highlight the new phaser, so that by the time we get to the episode and it's used in the episode, people will just kind of, you know, just kind of accept it.
Right, right.
So it did become part of the minutia that got distracting.
Exactly.
And it is a very cool looking phaser. If you watch the vignette, you get to see it up close, and you know, you have a little bit of what my family has always called a Roddenberry moment, where the characters are all kind of giving each other a hard time.
Yes.
This instance, giving McCoy a hard time about not wanting to learn how to use the new phaser.
Yeah. you know, guys, that's something else. That's something else that I feel like a lot of fan productions have missed out on, and that is the humor of Star Trek.
Yeah.
A lot of fan productions, I mean, they run around with phasers and they fight the Klingons and they they have aliens, and they and everybody does the stereotypical Spock fascinating kind of thing, but they don't capture the humor of the character relationships, and so that was something that I wanted us to capture as well in Star Trek Continues.
Well, not just the humor, but the soul of the entire thing as well. You know, like how a lot of other productions are. I was skeptical at first, kind of the way you were describing it, until you put up the vignettes up on the big screen you guys had at the con, and that's when I finally got it. I was like, yeah.
I'm so glad. Have you seen all three of them now, Bob?
I have. Well, you showed us two of them, didn't you, at the con?
Did I? Yeah, I didn't remember how many I showed.
They've been all three. In any case, I went back to my hotel room and watched them again and again and again anyway on my laptop. So I have seen them, and I instantly got it. I instantly knew exactly what you meant when you were talking about, you know, having that, you know, it's not just all about the CGI and the special effects and characters running with phasers. It's actually going to be this really story-driven machine, and it's going
to
be
awesome. It's about the characters. And Bob, can I play a little? Can I play a little test with you?
Sure.
Did you notice? Now, be honest with me.
Okay.
Did it when you watched the vignettes, like right off the bat, the first time you watched them? Did you notice that the lights on the bridge weren't flashing?
That is honestly something I did not look for. I know
exactly.
You mentioned it.
No, that's the right answer. And you know why? Because what was happening in the foreground had your attention.
Exactly. Well, that's even something you had mentioned. I'll go ahead and let you tell the story about it, but how you guys hadn't finished one part of the bridge or so yet with the there's some LED project that you were talking about.
Yeah. Well, what had happened was when we got down there to shoot the vignettes, they hadn't – the people that were working on the electrical, making all of the little computer screens on the bridge flash, they hadn't gotten to that yet.
Yeah.
And so we shot the sequence. We shot all of the vignettes, and then I went home and I edited them, and we sound designed them, and we released them. And not one person – now, maybe – I'm sure there were people out there. But not one person commented to me, of all of the hundreds of positive comments, not one person said, I can't believe the lights weren't flashing on the bridge. It was so, you know, man, that's pretty crummy. No. And the reason is because story is the point.
They weren't getting caught up in the minor details there.
Exactly. You know what? If your actors are boring, that's when the viewer's eyes start wandering and start looking for things in the background. But you know what? As beautiful as the sets may be, at the end of the day, they're just background. The actors have to be able to tell a good story, because it doesn't matter how beautiful the sets are if the story is kind of shallow or the actors are kind of lame. You know what I mean? And so that's our focus.
Now,
it's not to say we didn't build amazing sets, because we did. And when you see them, you'll be like, oh my God, look at that. but the story that's taking place in the foreground is the priority.
Now, I do have a question about that story, because I was a little puzzled when I saw one of the things that it was happening in the vignette. You have the scene where Uhura and Chekov and Sulu are kind of fooling around, taking turns in the captain's chair, which is a great scene.
Yeah.
The actors are all selling it. But I was a little confused, because Uhura makes a comment about how cool it will be when the first starship is captained by a woman. Now,
right.
In your version, are there no women captains in Starfleet?
Well, were there starship captains in TOS?
Well, I mean, we only ever saw one other starship captain in TOS.
Well,
we saw
several. We saw Ron Tracy of the Exeter. We saw Decker of the Constellation. We saw Bob Wesley of the Lexington. We saw several. But my point is, this show was made in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And women were getting a lot of rights and a lot of new opportunities that they long deserved but had not gotten. But there, I don't believe at the time there were any women captains. So my point with the my goal with that vignette was to say that there will be, and you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility, but at the moment there weren't. And so, you know, Uhura's line was, you know, the best starship in the fleet will be the first one commanded by a woman. That was what she said. And she kind of said it tongue in cheek, but I think with the full expectation that one day very soon there would be a female captain. And of course, Kirk reinforces that by saying, you know, you've got what it takes to command, and I can't imagine a better female captain than you, Uhura. Someday, I you know, that's going to happen, and I believe in you. That was the whole point of that little thing, is rather than come on the bridge and scold them and reprimand them for messing around in the chair and all of that, they expect to be reprimanded, and Kirk, in classic Kirk style, sits down and looks them in the face and says, you know what? Each one of you have what it takes to command, and someday you're going to make amazing captains.
Aww.
Anders. So,
Bob, did you have a question you were about to ask? I feel like I cut you off.
I was just going to warn Vic that you're heading into nerd continuity territory now.
I know, right?
with the question Orin's trying to pitch at you, because he's going to bring up, I think, you're going to bring up the Enterprise captain, aren't you?
I wasn't really planning to. I mean, if you watch, it's mainly that I've always assumed that the fact that there were no women captains portrayed in TOS, I've always assumed that as a limitation of the era in real life.
Yeah.
And like, we did see in Enterprise Captain Erica Hernandez, who was the captain of the second Enterprise type vessel that they had. But I'm not gonna start, you know, questioning you over particular, you know, canon continuity issues. I just wanted to know what your intention was in that scene.
Well, let me say this. I have absolutely no problem with female captains, and I think that you are absolutely right. The absence of any female captains was a reflection of the period in which the original series was made. But I would also submit that the presence of the female, the purposeful presence of the female captain in Enterprise was also the producers, you know, wanting to say, hey, we've got no problem with there being female captains. Let's make one. Because, you know, Enterprise was made, what, 30 years after TOS?
Probably more than that, but yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, you see my point. So, if you were to ask Gene Roddenberry, he probably would have had no problem with female captains. And so I certainly don't have any problem with it. But at the moment, where the series ended in 1969, we did not meet, we had not yet met any female captains.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? That's a wide open ball field for Star Trek Continues.
Yeah, is that something we should be keeping our eyes and ears open for?
Exactly, because we can pick up where the original, we're picking up exactly where the original series left off, and our long-term goal, God willing, is to do year 4 and year 5 of the 5-year mission.
Oh, so you could possibly be planting a little Chekhov's gun there, huh? Well, although, since it's Star Trek, the Chekhov's gun phrase works differently, but you know what I mean.
I do.
Don't be silly, Grace. Chekhov is in operations, not security. Ugh. What was that, Bob?
Nothing. I'm making poor jokes.
That's kind of what the rest of us are doing too. So,
since we're on the subject of writing, I want to mention the writing contest that you guys have going, which is I believe it is going until the 24th.
Yeah.
And that is a contest to submit a 10-page script treatment.
Let me just go ahead and tell you the reason behind the kind of the thinking behind that.
Please.
I am absolutely positive that there are some amazing TOS stories out there.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal is, the challenge is to find them. I believe that there are people out there that have come up with some great stories, But there are also a lot of lame stories.
This is true.
And I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that have made up some Star Trek stories where they imagine Kirk and Spock and McCoy doing something, or they've made up a story where Scotty does this, or what if this happened to Sulu? And they've sent them to me. I've got 20 or 30 different stories that people have sent me personally, and they're nice, they're okay, but I'm looking for something very, very special for Star Trek Continues. I'm looking for something that challenges our actors and something that really feels like it could have been an original series episode. Not a fan fiction, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fine line there, and I can't even describe it, but I know it when I read it. So I was talking with some of our other team a couple of months ago, and I said to them, quote, I know there are some great Star Trek stories out there if we can only find them. And somebody said, why don't we have a contest and let people submit some story ideas? Because you know what? We've spent all of the money to build the sets and cast the crew and put together an amazing production team. We've got everything in place. All we need now are good scripts. So that's the goal, is to get ourselves some really good, compelling scripts.
There's some good potential there, but there's also a lot of potential to have a lot of mediocre stuff to have to wade through. Are you at all afraid that's going to trip you guys up? Or?
Well, I hope not. I hope not.
And
that's a necessary risk.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why we didn't ask for scripts. We asked for treatments.
Right. Makes
sense. You could get through them more quickly. And you know what? You can read something. You can start reading something, and within about a paragraph or two, you know whether you like where it's going or not.
Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough.
You know?
Yeah.
And on that note, are you looking for a story that is going to use primarily existing assets, like something without a lot of guest stars? Because, you know, you might not be able to use a story where someone writes in a point and then a giant, you know, red genie appears. So just like, what kind of, is there anything in particular that you're looking for?
How much license for creativity are you giving people here also?
I'm looking for story. I'm looking for something that grabs the imagination. And as far as creativity, Grace, I feel like there was so much creativity in the original series of Star Trek. And I want to find stories like that. I want to find somebody who writes imaginative stories and takes these characters that we love so much to places and situations that are compelling and interesting. And if the story calls for a red genie and it's a great story, by golly, we'll figure out a way to do a red genie.
All right.
But again, it really comes back to story.
All right. Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know. Thank you.
On
the
you can expect an email from him.
You know what, you guys? Let me say something else. We've got some amazing VFX people working on Star Trek Continues. So I'm not afraid of an episode that would require some special effects. My point is, it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the story. If the effect serves an amazing story, then I'm all for it. And we'll figure out a way to do it. But we don't want to do effects just for the sake of effects.
Right. And on the question, on the subject of writing, how are you guys handling that for the episodes proper? Do you have a writing team, or do you say, hey, it's your turn to write the episode this week?
Well, no, we don't have a writing team. This first episode, the first episode that's getting ready to premiere at Phoenix Comic Con on Friday, May 24th, I wrote the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I handed it off to two seasoned writers named Steve Fratt and Jack Trevino. Mm-hmm. And they wrote the actual script, and then they gave it to me, and I did what Gene Roddenberry did. I script edited. I I went through it and I tweaked the dialogue and I changed some things and I omitted some things that I didn't think were important. And I, you know, and I messed with it a little bit. And then that's the episode we shot. I've got several people that have submitted some story ideas to me, and I've said to them, I love this idea. Let's write, why don't you write a script on this idea? And then I'll do the same thing with that script. I'll do the same thing that Gene Roddenberry, as the exec producer, did.
Mm-hmm.
He'll script edit it, and he'll, you know, he'll tweak it, and he'll work it to make it, you know, a sharp 50-minute episode.
Okay.
But we don't have a team,
right,
per se. The scripts could come from anybody, anywhere that would like to see, you know, that have a great story and want to see it turned into an episode, want to be able to see it visualize and actually manifest, you know, on screen.
And when you were working on Starship Farragut, which just to clear up for anyone who isn't sure, Starship Farragut is a fan series for anyone listening, and it's quite good. I recommend checking it out. But when you worked on The Price of Anything, I think is the name of the episode.
Yes.
Did you, because you're listed as the director, but did you have any influence over the script?
I had some involvement, but not a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
The script was written by Paul Sieber, I believe, and John Broughton and I made a couple of changes here and there, for the sake of the story. As the director, I made some kind of directorial changes for things that I thought would be more powerful or would play more dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
The Price of Anything was the first thing that I ever did with Farragut, and I just really, we had the best time with these guys. Mike Bednar, Holly Bednar, John Broughton, and Greg Green, and Royal Weaver, and John Sims, and Dan Scanlon, and all of these great people with Farragut. We really struck up a great friendship, and that was what actually became the seed, you know, the catalyst for us to go, hey, you know what? I have always wanted to do this. What say we pool our resources? And I can bring a lot of production people and production expertise and directing expertise, lighting, camera, editing, acting. I can bring that to Starship Farragut. And then people like Mike Bednar can bring his set building expertise, and John Broughton could bring his costuming expertise. And I would bring in myself and a partner, our financial resources. And rather than having a 3,000 square foot little building, let's get a 9,600 square foot building, move your beautiful bridge set to that facility and build out all the rest of the sets. And Farragut will have full use of those sets. And Star Trek Continues will have full use of those sets. And we will bring our assets into each other's productions.
And did you already have that in mind when you got into costume as Captain Kirk in the episode?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I played a little cameo in the beginning of the Price of Anything episode, the Farragut episode, but I don't know that the idea had been as fully developed as it ultimately came to be.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I know we had no thought of getting a bigger facility and building all the rest of the sets. And by the way, let me say something real quick to you guys personally and to your listeners.
Go ahead.
We have every intention of offering tours.
I was hoping to hear.
Absolutely. And you know what else, by the way? Our studio is not out in the middle of BFE. It is, you know, it's not like you fly into this little podunk regional airport and then you drive for 3 hours and then you come into this little town and there's our sets.
You now, hire a Sherpa to find your way into town.
Exactly. You rent a couple of camels and you make a day of it. No, our set, you fly into Jacksonville Airport, a major city, major international airport, and our sets are 25 minutes from Jacksonville Airport in a wonderful little, fully developed little city called Kingsland, Georgia. Literally right on the other side of the state line in Georgia. They're very easy to get to. Plenty of hotels and fully developed little city, restaurants, hotels, stores. It's a great city, a great little town. And that's where we're based. And it's easy to get to. And we have been talking about, making tours available to people that want to come and realize kind of a childhood dream of walking through the sets laid out exactly as they were in the original.
Now Disneyland, that Vic Mignogna all up ends with his Star Trek set.
You know what's funny, dude? It is right off the interstate on the way to Disneyland.
They just need the billboard. That's all you need now, and you'd be set.
The nerdiest place on earth.
I was just thinking, we need to hook you guys up with the people doing the TNG bridge restoration project.
You know what? I happen to be very good friends with Houston Huddleston.
Awesome.
And the people that are doing the next gen bridge. And we've been talking about possibly pooling our resources in that way as well. And maybe, you know, how cool would it be to make Kingsland, Georgia, the Star Trek, you know, capital, you know, tourist capital of the world, you know?
I'm just saying, as long as you got the two sets right next to each other, maybe there just would happen to be a time travel episode. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
You never know. Never know.
Can put that idea out there.
Regarding your everyone else's ability to be able to contribute to this project. I'm not a writer, for instance. I'm 3,000 miles away in Seattle, Washington, from where your set is. So it'd be hard for me to come hold a boom mic for you guys. But if I wanted to contribute in some way, do you guys have a Kickstarter available, or is there any?
Well, and you know what? I really, really appreciate you mentioning that, Bob. And let me answer. First of all, let me say this. You know how far away you are? You're about $300 away.
I am $300 away. This is true. That's true.
I'm just saying. You are a plane flight away from coming and being a part of this. And for people that would like to contribute, I really appreciate you mentioning that. I'm currently working on financing alternatives for future episodes. And there will be a Kickstarter, and I would be very, very honored by having you involved. Let me say this to all of the fans and you. Mm-hmm. When we were building the sets and going to the degree that we were to prepare this episode, I'll bet I had 100 people say to me, why don't you launch a Kickstarter? Why don't you get a Kickstarter going to raise money for the episode? And you know what I said? My answer was this. I don't feel like it's ethically right for me to ask people to give money to something I haven't done yet.
That's a fair answer.
I thought to myself, what I should do is I should fund the first episode. I should personally fund the first episode, basically make what would be considered a proof of concept. Show people what we can do. Show people what we're capable of. And when they see it finished, completed, executed on screen, they'll know what they're giving to. And I would feel a lot better about people giving to something that they've seen done. They know that it's being done. Not they hope it's done. They hope their money goes to something good. But rather than that, they can see the first episode and they can want to be a part of something like that. And we will have proven that we can do it, and we are doing it. They'll see the sets built. They'll see the actors on screen. They'll see the amazing lighting and camera work and the great story and Michael Forrest reprising his role on this episode. And Jamie Bamber from Battlestar Galactica making a cameo. And Grant Imahara from Mythbusters playing Sulu, and Chris Duhon playing his father's role as Scotty, and Marina Sirtis as the voice of our computer. They'll see it all actually in front of them on screen, and they won't be asked to give to something that hasn't been created yet.
I really like how you dropped the name Michael Forrest, because I was like, Michael Forrest, who is that? I should know who that is. And I just checked it. So for anyone listening at home, that was Apollo, I believe, from Who Mourns for Adonai.
Yes.
So now I'm really excited, because that was a fantastic episode of Star Trek. And if you
Yes, it was. And that was one of the favorites. That was a great second season episode. And a lot of people remember that as one of the favorites. And Michael Forrest is the guest star of our premiere episode. So I will let your imagination take it from there.
Oh, Vic, just hearing you describe all this, you just sound like a kid in a candy store.
Well, that's actually something I was thinking of here. And that's a question that I sometimes get asked just in email or when I play online, Star Trek Online, which I'm sure you're familiar with, or at least heard of it and such. Uh-huh. Is you know, what do you consider a Star Trek fan? And the one thing I can now take away from this interview is that your energy, your drive, your passion is so apparent and obvious that I can now say, go look up Vic Mignogna on Wikipedia and you'll have your answer. This is
years from now, we'll be able to tell our grandchildren, there was a fanboy right there, like no other.
Today, just actually point him at just Star Trek Continues, because you are so inspirational as a Star Trek fan, having listened to what you said at the con, having you here now, you know, talking about it and such. It's just, it's amazing how much drive and passion and energy you've put into this project, funding it yourself, getting all these people together, working with the Starship Farragut guys, getting the set all built and stuff in a proper studio. It's amazing. I can't express it really any other way.
Well, and you know what, Bob? It means the world to me that you would say that. And thank you for saying that. But you know what I'm super excited about is that I'm not alone. I have put together a group of people who all share the same passion. I've got a guy named Ralph Miller. He is as big a Star Trek fan as I am, but you know what else he is? He's an expert sound man. And I've got a guy named Matt Busey who loves Star Trek, but you know what else he is? He's a brilliant, genius cinematographer.
You've got quite the Rolodex there.
Well, you see what I'm saying? What I'm saying is, you know what, you guys? Here's the thing. All of these, I've got all of these people involved in Star Trek Continues who are really, really good at what they do. But the commonality is when they were kids, they were huge Star Trek fans. And so Star Trek Continues is giving us all the dream privilege of merging our childhood love with all of the creative skills that we've developed over the years. And now as grown-ups, we're able to put them together. And you know what? I've had people say to me, how are you making money with this, Vic? How are you making money with this? How are you funding it? How did you build all these sets? Well, my answer is this. God has been very good to me, and he has blessed me with a lot of opportunities, and I've worked very hard. And this dream project is 35 years coming.
Wow.
And I have poured a lot of my own money into it with no expectation of making money out of it, because it's a labor of love. It's a passion project. And the chance to get to play Star Trek with all of these friends and make and take all of my production skills that I developed through college and for years after college, directing, shooting. My college degree is in film. Mm-hmm. So to take all of the skills that I've developed in production over the years and to merge them with my childhood passion for Star Trek, you can't put a price on that. And, you know, Star Trek is a licensed property. So we're not allowed to make money at it anyway, nor do I have any desire to. But there are a lot of people out there just like me who would love to. You know what? I've got another guy named Andy Loomis who is an amazing grip. He has a grip truck with a jib, a 17-foot jib arm, and a dolly, and all of these great tools. And you know what else? He's a Star Trek fan since childhood.
I'm sensing a pattern here.
And he came all the way across the country to come and be a part of our premiere episode. And when you see the episode and you see these crane shots and these dolly shots, that's Andy Loomis living his childhood dream.
Wow. All
right. Well,
I can't think of a more inspirational project right now. I just can't.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah. And when yeah. when you hear the amazing sound design of our first episode, that's Ralph Miller living his childhood dream.
Now, speaking of dreams, we are coming up to the end of our time, and I have asked a lot of questions, and I have very much enjoyed my answers. But, Grace, mm-hmm. do you want to ask a final question before we wrap this up? Because I'm putting you on the spot, Grace, just a little bit.
I know. Just give me a second to pull up my questions really fast. I just want to say it's been a pleasure having you on here, Vic.
It is my pleasure, you guys. It is my pleasure.
No, it's been our pleasure. No, really.
And of course, no. Bob.
Now I know that Bob is in Seattle. Oren, where are you located?
We're actually pretty much all in Seattle. Or Grace is in Tacoma.
Yeah.
But we're all.
Oh, okay.
Tacoma is the redheaded stepchild of Seattle, pretty much.
Tacoma's got all the cool thrift shops. You guys have that on us.
That's about it, though. That's about it. And a thrift shop doesn't mean much when you're broke, so.
I suppose.
But I gotta know, Vic, this is just one thing I was curious about, even for a little bit, playing a character like Captain Kirk, which, from what it sounds like, you've got an incredible respect for the character and this huge love for the original series. Wasn't that intimidating to do? And were you at all just tempted to Shatner it up?
Thank you. Good question. Here's my answer. Through my anime voice acting career, I've done a lot of conventions.
Yeah.
And I have, over the last year and a half or so, have done several conventions with William Shatner and have become friends with him. Literally become friends with him to the point where he knows me by name. We've had dinner together. I've been at his office in Studio City. He asked me to call him Bill. I mean, I've actually become friends with him, and I will let you guys in on a little secret. I have never even spoken the words Star Trek in his presence. He has no idea that I'm doing what I'm doing. He has no idea that I've done all that I've done with this series because I want him to consider me a friend and an actor, a peer, a fellow actor peer like he currently does, because we do conventions together. And, you know, he seems, you know, my autograph table has sat right beside his. So so he knows me as an actor who does conventions with him, and I don't want him to, you know, to suddenly put up a wall because he thinks I'm some kind of a crazy Star Trek fan.
Are we?
But
all
having said that, in answer to your question, Grace, William Shatner is Captain Kirk. I have sat at dinner.
Wow.
I have sat at dinner enough with William Shatner and listened to him tell stories and watched his mannerisms to know that Captain Kirk is William Shatner. Now, having said that, I don't ape William Shatner. I don't do the stereotypical Captain Kirk. I'm not going to do that. I have way too much love and respect for the character. However, at the same time, there is a Captain Kirk that we remember from the original series. And that's what I want to continue. I'll be honest with you guys. I think that Shatner and Captain Kirk inspired and influenced me enough as a little boy that I can't help but act in a style similar to the way Shatner played Captain Kirk. And I don't think that's a bad thing, and I make no apology for it.
Good answer.
But I'm not going to impersonate him. You know what? You guys watch the vignettes if you haven't already, and you tell me, am I aping Captain Kirk, William Shatner? Am I Shatnering it up?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
But there's enough of it there that you're like, yeah, okay, I can see Captain Kirk here. But
But you're not doing it just to be Captain Kirk, though. You're doing it in service of the scene that's taking place, you know.
Exactly.
Like, right when, you know, you guys are transitioning from Turnabout Intruder into the vignette, for instance, you know, it's all in service of having that conversation with Scotty and
right.
Who else is there?
Spock. And you know, Spock.
It's in service of that. It's not so much I am playing Captain Kirk to be Captain Kirk, as so much as I'm playing Captain Kirk because he's an integral part of this story and this scene that is taking place right now.
Exactly. And there will be several moments in this first episode that's coming up. The premiere episode, Pilgrim of Eternity, is the name of the episode. There are many moments where, you know, you'll very much see the Captain Kirk that Shatner created. But that's what I want to honor. That's what I fell in love with. That's the Captain Kirk that I loved. And so my desire is to continue that Captain Kirk.
Nice.
A fine job you do of it.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me, and I will look very forward to you guys seeing the first episode, and maybe we can have another interview after the premiere episode is released.
You can expect an email from us.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here.
Thank you for stopping when after I yelled at you, Vic, and it's a you had a mob of people around you, so it was a little, I think it was maybe a little rude of me to be like overpowering everybody and going, I want to talk to this guy.
No, I'm glad you did, Bob. I'm glad you did.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and also to Bob. It was good to have you back and for arranging all of this.
Hey, you bet.
And I think with that, because we did promise that we wouldn't keep you much longer past 8, we will go ahead and wrap this up. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and this will be All Things Trek, signing off.